Hey guys, welcome back to another installment of your favorite show, the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. This is a really cool one today. We got two really cool guests, but let's get into the sponsors real quick before we get this show on the road. We are happy to work with these guys every single week, just supporting entrepreneurs and small business. So it's what we love to do. And one of them happens to be Manskirt Brewing, just home to some awesome craft beer in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Go check out the old bank building on Main Street and check out some of their seasonally inspired ales, usually 8 rotating tap handles. They always have events. It's a great place to go, you know, play a board game, listen to some music, and just enjoy some craft beer. They got their Baltic Porter on tap, which is fully regimental, and their Nitro Irish Stout. Make sure you go check out Joe Fisher in his Manskirt at Manskirt Brewing. Now, we happen to have Demented Brewing, which is located in Middlesex, New Jersey. Just a very cool brewery to go get a variety of craft beer. 16 rotating tap handles, barrel clubs, sour clubs. Every Sunday they release something new. They just released a triple IPA called Hidden Gems, which is a triple IPA brewed with pineapple, and it is delicious. So go into their amazing tap room and go check out Demented Brewing. Now, Wolf Nation, WULF Nation, which stands up for Wake Up, Live Free Apparel, the world's next hottest and biggest designer brand. No matter what your goals are in life, as long as you are pursuing them, Wolf Nation is the brand for you. Go check them out. Go check out. They got a whole bunch of new stuff. They got spring wolfwear for both men, women, accessories, hats, bags, mugs. They're taking pre-orders right now. So go check them out on Instagram and DM them at Wolf Nation or email them at wolf@wolfnation.com. Follow them on Twitter. Put your orders in. Just a really cool clothing line, and they are really starting to make things pop, if you will, right now. So go check out their website at wolfnation.rocks. Again, that is Wake Up, Live Free. Now, Susan Robb is one of our sponsors out of Toronto, Canada. Susan works with senior executives in leadership development and also runs a business as a speaker agent for some great speakers that have been on our show. So her and her pal Kim, Kim Ward from Wisconsin, they've been a guest on the show too, they are tirelessly advocating and raising money to inspire and empower a group of women and kids in Nepal. So far, their efforts have raised enough money to put 14 kids into school for the very first time and helped a group of ladies start a sewing business making quilts. 13 of those quilts have been made and shipped and sold in 4 countries, and all proceeds go right back into their Nepal outreach program for the next phase of sustainability. So go check out their GoFundMe at /Vimla, V-I-M-L-A. Just a great cause to get behind. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. We work for Trivia Company every week all over New Jersey in beer bars and breweries. You can come play trivia. It's absolutely free to play. Win prizes. I host on Wednesdays at Tap House 15. So Trivia Revolution fueled by craft beer. All right. This week on the podcast, it is time to party hard with the one and only Andrew WK. Just a really awesome guest, down-to-earth guy, mysterious dude. Just loved him. And then we also have a man by the name of Peter Giljum from Sweden. He is an animal trainer, works in zoos all over the world. Just a really unique and fun episode with that, guys. Enjoy the podcast.
Hello, this is Andrew WK, just informing you that we're partying extraordinarily hard right here on Verbal Shenanigans.
Hello, this is Peter Giljum, all the way from Sweden. I'm the animal trainer out here in Sweden, the owner of ZooSpanspool.com, and welcome to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun. Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
That intro, I really do. I love this song. Gets me fired up to talk nonsense about my life here, and bring to you guys another installment of your favorite weekly show, the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to episode, I think by the time this goes up, this will be about episode 195, something like that. The catalog is getting huge. We're working our way to episode 200. We have mass things planned. Mass things. By mass, I mean we currently have nothing planned. So hopefully we get something in the next few weeks. But if not, it'll just be status quo. It'll be your weekly favorite show. I'm just rambling here. But everybody, welcome back to the show. If you checked in last week, who do we have on last week? I don't even remember. Last week we had Michael Glenn, the first ever paraplegic hot air balloon pilot. And this week is no different. Very interesting. I think you may have heard of the guest we got coming on in a minute, but we have to get the King of Georgia himself on the line here. So let's try to give Berlew a call. He was having some technical difficulties, so let's call him now and see if we can get the Georgia Peach himself on the line here. Hey, Berlew.
Hey, Scotty.
How's my special little Georgia Peach doing down there?
Oh, just peachy dandy.
Peachy keen?
Mm-hmm.
Millions of peaches?
Yep.
Peaches
this
for
place
free?
Isn't the pit.
Oh, I see what you did there. I see.
Yeah.
And I hear what you did there. But anyway, buddy,
peaches have pits.
Peaches do have pits. Peaches, and our show is also the pits. But how's it going down there? I haven't talked to you in like 2 weeks over the information superhighway. I haven't talked to you. We took a little break. We had a couple random interviews. Like on this episode, there'll be two interviews one interview that was done like a week ago. And oh god, I'm dropping computers. One that was done this morning. There's a whole lot of things going on. And we have another interview coming up. So this is a little bit of confusion, mass confusion going on right now.
Yeah, it's craziness, man. It's all craziness.
So how's it going in Georgia as it pours snow today again in New Jersey on April 2nd?
Well, I'm in shorts. It was a high of 82. I'm just living the dream. Of course, with my traffic and my work day, I'm pretty much living the dream inside of a cubicle, then go home and do this. But hey, at least I could say it didn't have snow.
I'm pretty much done with the snow at this point, as I feel most people are in the Northeast here. It was kind of nice out yesterday and Saturday, and then of course a nice little snowstorm over the night. And again, our lawns and cars are covered with snow, but it's okay. We'll get there eventually. Nothing like the Mets-Phillies game being canceled due to snowfall.
Yeah. I wish our new manager could have used some analytics on how we could have beat the Mets in sub-30-degree weather, as he's been so brilliant so far.
Yes.
Our opening day, we had a 5-0 lead, and our starting pitcher, Aaron Nola, was just dealing. And after 68 pitches, 5 1/3 innings, he's like, nope, the numbers say that you struggle your third time around against batters. Then we proceeded to give up 8 runs in the last of the 3 innings and blow that one. And then after winning one, then we got walloped 15-2 and had to put a center fielder out there to pitch an inning.
So you're saying the Phillies are in midseason form, is what you're saying?
I'm saying he's in a little bit of trouble when you consider the Eagles won a Super Bowl, the Sixers are going to the playoffs hot, the Flyers pretty much are guaranteed a playoff spot. I mean, I think technically they still have to clinch, but they're looking like the wild card or the final quote-unquote playoff spot. So it's
Villanova. Villanova might win tonight.
Yeah, that's true. Villanova. So you don't, when all those things are ending soon, you don't want everybody to turn around and say, wait a minute, you're the crap one.
Yeah, well, you know, Philly's been through a bit of a rough run. It seems to be on the uprise, unfortunately, even though I can't stand them. But it seems like they're on the way up. It doesn't look like the Eagles are going anywhere. And, well, you know, Phillies, they'll eventually be good again.
Oh, yeah. On a side point, the manager at 1-2 and losing those two games already pronounced that the Phillies are going to the playoffs.
Oh, that's good.
So, that's great. I'm like, oh, man, I thought I'd have to wait because you're terrible. But, you know, he calmed me down. So it's all good.
Yeah. I mean, usually generally guarantees always work.
Yeah, when a manager is three games into his career, that's the smartest thing to do. Yeah. Say beyond a shadow of a doubt, success.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's the Phillies, so something strange will happen.
Yeah.
You know, they're other than that championship, they're pretty much they were right in the same boat as the Mets for many, many years. They were pretty easy to make fun of. So you're just working your way back to your status quo now. You're just working that whole.
Yeah.
You want to do like what you guys were during like the 90s and 80s.
Yeah, we're with a lot of nice hard work, we'll be mid-level crap. That's our goal in life.
You'll be back to that losingest franchise in sports again soon enough. Don't worry, pal. But in case
this is how we get soccer to get popular in Philadelphia. The Phillies sucking through the summer.
All right. So So, Berlo, I told you at the end of the last episode, which was 2 weeks ago for us, so it was only 1 week for the listeners, but I told you that I was going to go curling. For the new listeners, a couple weeks ago, I don't know, probably about 8 episodes ago or something along those lines, if you go back and you look for our interview with John Morris, he was a curler, a Canadian curler. Gold medalist, two-time gold medalist, one for mixed doubles and whatnot, and with the Winter Olympics. My pal Dean Gemmel, who's a comic at a kind of Jersey in New York, and he might be the only comic to also have a credit of like American curler, like champion. Like, I don't think the curling comedy.
Considering how much we know people who steal, he may have started it, but there's a lot that followed just because.
Yeah, I don't think too many. He has too much competition in the comics going curling department. But Dean had reached out to me and he said, "Hey, I'm taking a bunch of guys curling. You know, if you want to come check it out." I said, "Absolutely! Like, when the hell am I ever going to get a chance to do this again?" Now, so we go to South Plainfield, New Jersey, and right away it's this little club, like, you know, kind of down these side streets, and it's the curling club of South Plainfield. It's the only one in New Jersey, apparently. And you walk in, and it's kind of like a clubhouse, like a small, like, there's a bar there, and like some little snacks, and some couches, and like TVs, so like a little tiny. You know,
kind of like a BFW almost?
A little bit, but like definitely like smaller kind of. But like you could see through the windows to the curling rink, I guess you would call it, the curling. And first impression was, wow, it's a lot longer than it looks on TV. It's long. It's like longer than a bowling alley.
Okay.
So I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. So right away, like, you have to start getting your shoes, kind of like bowling shoes. And there's like basically a big trunk full of shoes, and your one foot has the slidey foot that you see like them slide on.
Mm-hmm.
But the other foot is like a regular shoe kind of. So I like,
now do they make you give in your regular shoes so you don't steal the curling shoes?
No. Well, considering all like the shoes we were using were in like a big trunk, like that. It was just like assorted shoes, and it wasn't too much of a demand, I don't think. And it's kind of like a club, like a private club, so I'm guessing most of the people who come have their own shoes. Like, these are probably like, you know, assorted shoes that you can use for people that never curled before.
When they bring the friends, these are the friends' shoes.
Yeah, friend shoes, yeah. So there's a couple like other comics and a couple other people I don't know, and we go on the rink, and right away it's pretty cool. It's like you're able to get a beer and bring it in, and kind of, you know, right away, like the whole time I was thinking like this, if I had money, I would love to open up like a curling place in like Brooklyn or Hobo, like But it's like more of like where, have you ever been to Topgolf or seen Topgolf?
No.
Well, it's like, it's almost like bowling, but like a driving range where like you hang out with your friend and you can play this game. It like marks your balls and like whoever got to the target and stuff like that. I'm thinking it'd be really cool to have like a lane, like curling, where you're able to kind of throw it like bocce ball and then it scores it and then like brings the stones back. You know, like it'd be fun way to hang out. So right away I'm like, wow, this would be fun like to have and do. But curling looks incredibly easy on TV, like most sports do. Curling is not incredibly easy, Berlu.
No. Like, did you look? Well, honestly, like, now we've had conversations, and obviously, when we had interview, like John, not like 3-hour conversations, but we kind of chatted after the interview, and obviously, we heard from John saying, you know, this isn't. I know everybody makes jokes about it in the U.S., but this is a serious thing. But like going into it, were you like, yeah, whatever, what? Let's see how it's done.
Honestly, I think the interview helped kind of me knowing ahead of time that it wasn't going to be so easy and there was things that I wouldn't know about the sport, obviously. And then like talking to Dean, too, like how much goes into it. So I think I, more than the other people were there, knew that it wasn't going to be so easy. Like it wasn't going to be like...
Well, so there were some trash talkers going into it.
100%. Guys like, oh, this is going to be no... And right away, you know, we're with like, you know, there's a big fat guy I'm with and he can barely stand on the ice. And, you know, you forget that you're on ice, you know? You forget that it's not mm-hmm. like, you know, they slide and make it look so easy. It is a little like grittier than like normal ice. Like it kind of feels like gravel a little bit. So right away, the first thing we do, we get these like PVC things that we hold in our hands. So you don't do it with the stone. You're just learning how to push off and use it. So pushing off is really hard. And the first thing I noticed was that the line that they have to like throw it before, like before they, you know, you got to release it before you cross that line is really far. Yeah. It's probably about 15, 20 feet to the line. So you're gliding.
Okay.
Well, you know, like he showed us how he did. He's like, you guys aren't going to reach that line. And he's like, but that was really far. And like a couple times, it's really hard to stay balanced. Like you're, you know, your foot's gliding behind you and you're trying to stay real kind of still and stable. And so just learning how to slide, that took a while. A bunch of people fall. I fell a few times, like trying to get up, like slippery. But I thought I had a pretty good slide. I was judging myself based on the group. So,
were you every time did you throw? Did you say it's electric and let go?
Boogie woogie. Yeah. So we did the slides, and he was really good at teaching too, because he like we went in like a pretty good. We only had about 2 hours there, so we went from like the slide till then he like let us try to throw the stone a few times. What I did find was interesting is, I guess why it's called curling, you know, you're not throwing the stone straight. Like you're not trying to make it go straight. You're actually, when you release it, you're either releasing it clockwise or counterclockwise. Okay. And the guy on the other end, the skip, who is like your captain kind of, he's telling you mm-hmm. where he wants it and where you should aim it to curve. So it's pretty interesting.
It's almost like bowling where people think you're just throwing it straight, but you're getting a curl going or a curve onto it.
Yeah, and I had asked Dean, I said, do you guys ever throw it straight? He says, no, because the stone will naturally start to curve one way or the other. So if you try to throw it straight, it's going to end up either left or way right of where mm-hmm. you're aiming at. So I thought that was pretty
interesting. Did they put up gutters for you?
No, but what I did notice that you don't put much effort at all like into throwing it. Like you don't, you know, you're not really shoving it. You're almost just kind of finding a way to like release it, because anytime I put a little effort in, that thing just sailed right through the target, like right to the back of the house, as they call it, which is the target area.
Okay.
So it was cool, because then he had us play a game. I'll tell you what, another thing that looks, people make fun of, like the sweeping, that is not easy either. That is actually very, very tiring. And we were doing it with like rubber guards on our feet, so we weren't slipping. But I can imagine with them off, like it's hard to master that technique. It was, all in all, it was like a really fun experience. I hope to go again. He said he would take me in like a smaller group, or like me and Alex can go down there. But what a what a great experience. It was pretty cool to like have play a sport I have no idea, never really even seen. You know, like there's a lot of sports I haven't played, but I've seen people play, and this one's like I've never seen mm-hmm. in person before.
Now, did you guys actually play a game, all you rookies together?
We did.
What was the outcome?
It was a very high scoring event. Our first game was 2-1.
Okay.
And okay. I guess in a game you have a certain amount of throws. Like a team has X amount of throws. And then I think I had to try to hit the last shot because I was the skip of my team. I think the other one was like 3-2 or something like that. We lost the second game, but it was definitely eye-opening, a lot of fun, and it's just I love that kind of thing, man. I love like learning something new like that, or even trying something new. It's just like, when the hell am I ever going to do that again?
Well, you just said in like a couple weeks.
Oh, hopefully.
I mean, you really didn't lay up that question that well. I got to be honest. That's podcasting 101. Just FYI.
Thanks, pal. Thanks.
But and I guess that's what I'm here for.
I guess let's get to our first guest in the episode. Now, Burley, you were this interview was recorded
last Wednesday.
Yeah, I was going to say a couple days ago.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty big one. It's a pretty big one.
I'm jealous.
It was the one and only. He was very big. I remember in my college years, he came out with the song "Party Hard." And he has this mystique about him. And that is Andrew WK. If you look up different theories on Andrew WK, there are people that think he's not the first Andrew WK, that the original one died, kind of like the Ultimate Warrior.
Okay, like Jesus.
Kind of like Jesus. But there's people.
He wasn't the real Messiah, but we feel he was a good guy, that Andrew WK.
Mm-hmm. So I was able to sit down with him. I was very happy to get in touch with him. And he just has this mystique about him. Very nice dude. I think I actually remember meeting him because he had a reputation for hanging out with his fans after the show and like having beers in the parking lot. And so he has a very, like, everyone seems to know who he is and has a story about him and has heard something or watched him or, you know. And he has very infectious music, toured with the Foo Fighters and a million different bands. So here is my interview with Andrew WK. Hello.
Hello, is Scott there, please?
Hey, is this Andrew?
Yes, hello, how are you?
Andrew, how is it going? Thanks for giving me a call, man, and appreciate the time.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for including me on the podcast.
Absolutely. So where are you calling from?
Well, I'm actually on my way to play a show, a festival, nice, in Boise in a few days.
Are you getting snow poured all over you? Because we are right now.
Oh, no. Is it snowing there already?
Yeah, we're in Jersey. It's just it's pouring snow again. Another nor'easter, so fun.
Well, I've been seeing about that, and we had to dodge it ourselves a few times, but we were able to, and I wonder maybe, well, Boise isn't that close to New Jersey, though.
No, yeah, that's true.
But I think it's going to snow. They said it's supposed to snow on the day of the festival, so it looks like it's going to hit everybody.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll survive. We'll be okay. But
yeah, exactly.
Andrew, I want to thank you for coming on. I was just saying right before you came on, you're one of these musicians that everybody seems to kind of know, and there's a certain, it almost seems like there's a mystery around you, like you're someone like a folk hero. Like I know guys who have remember you hanging out after shows, like at the I believe it was in the Birchill in New Jersey or a Warped Tour, you know, like everybody seems to know you, and if I'm correct. According to your like Wikipedia, you've basically been playing music for close to 25 years now.
Well, as a professional, it's only been really 18 years.
Right. Still pretty long time.
Yeah.
So where did you get your roots from? I know you you're a very good piano player, but where did you get your roots in music?
From the piano. Yeah, piano lessons that started age five or so. So yeah, I guess as far as playing music, it's been 33 years. It's a good number. And the piano was the root of everything. That before I ever heard any other music, I was hearing the piano. I mean, I suppose I heard some children's records and things like that, but before I heard electric guitar and knew about bands and even different genres, and I was taking these piano lessons, and my dad was taking piano lessons, and we always had a piano in the house. So it was right up there, same primal education, right, as learning to tie your shoes and learning how to ride a bike and learning how to write your name. So
you were like there more classically trained, right?
Yeah, just real traditional piano lessons.
Mm-hmm. So when you started, you know, getting into maybe rock music, what were some of your influences? Were you a punk rock guy? Were you a metal guy?
Well, I went to a high school that was very strange, I suppose. I guess you would call it sort of a freaky scene. Kind of more like, this was in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Right.
So it's quite radical. There's a tradition, for better or worse, of quite radical thought, at least coming out of the university or some segments of the university, especially in the 60s.
Right.
So Ann Arbor was similar to something like San Francisco was in the 1960s. Now, of course, this was far before I was even born. Mm-hmm. But that influence, that lingering tone remained in the town. So the music scene was very freaky. I mean, it was very strange music. I don't know that you could really classify it. It had aspects of punk at times, I suppose, because the people might have had colored hair or maybe were literally living on the street, right, by choice. People that were going against the grain in every possible way that they could. So the idea of a genre of music, that's the first thing to go.
Right.
That's the first thing to go. Even instruments were the second thing to go. and any kind of song structure, that was out the window. So that was really what I was exposed to after the piano lessons. It was quite striking. What an amazing contrast to go from this very rigorous, very straightforward musical education,
right,
into this complete free-for-all of crazy sounds and crazy people.
Right. So now you, when you were in high school and whatnot, after high school, was there any thought of like going to traditional college, or was it always music for you from the beginning?
It was never music in terms of a profession. Well, right. I never thought, I don't know exactly why, but I suppose because it was so fundamental,
right,
in my upbringing, it just didn't occur to me that you would do that as a career. To me, it would be like becoming a professional shoe tire or becoming a professional, I don't know.
Is that an option?
Writer.
Is that an
It probably is somewhere. Yeah, there is probably someone that has a job tying shoes. I'm sure there is. But it was something I figured I would always do. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think of it as a way to make money. I was thinking much more along the lines, like many young people, I was be a scientist or I'm going to be an architect.
Right.
I really liked painting and drawing and the visual arts. I thought about going to college for that. But in the end, it wasn't until I moved to New York with all these other ambitions of being a fashion designer or being a painter or all these other ideas, they all fell away. All my own ambitions and all my dreams that I had come up with, and all my tastes, basically, my preferences and opinions, they all fell away. They were all dashed away,
right,
by the intensity of New York City. And all that was left was what I had always already done, which was my music thing. But I never had ever dreamed or really even had the foggiest notion of being a frontman in a rock band or any kind of band. And again, even it is a bit odd to say that, because I had been recording and playing in bands with friends and stuff, but it would be like if you're a football fan and,
right,
you watch the games every day, you don't say, I'm going to be a football coach,
right,
until, you know, the party gods pluck you and say, nope, that is what you're going to do. You better get ready. You better figure out how to do it. So I figured out how to do it and got started.
All right, so let's take it there. Your Party Hard comes out, and your breakthrough comes, and it's the sound that almost sounds simplistic in some ways, but it seems to catch everybody's imagination at the time. I remember being in college and you know, Party Hard coming on all the time. Everyone kind of singing along. Now, you're this classically trained pianist. Was the goal to just, like, right off the bat, like, let's just make kind of simple-sounding hard rock party music? Or was it just, like, suggested to you? How did you find this sound?
Well, I think, I mean, that song, like most of the songs, was written on the keyboard, written on the piano.
Yep.
As I said, I don't want to ever make people think I'm some virtuoso piano player. Right. I don't really know how good I am or not. Some people think that I'm very good.
Well, I will say, my buddy Billy works, he works at SST Studios, and he told me the other day you were in, and he said you were awesome. So,
oh, well, I'm very familiar with that place, and yep. I've worked with SST for years, renting vans and equipment and all kinds of stuff, and so I take that as high praise. Well, anyway, as you yourself just described, it's not music that's meant to convey or impress. It's not meant to convey a virtuoso type of feeling or even impress someone on that level. It's meant to create a physical reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted to get out of music for my whole life. I mean, that's what I did get. The music I responded to, whether it was that crazy, freaky music in high school or my teachers playing piano pieces for me when I was really little,
mm-hmm.
or any music, does it change the way my body feels for the better? Does it make me feel more excited about being alive? And so I tried to make the music that I thought, for me, was the epitome of that excitement. What is the most intense, exciting, physically inspiring music that I can come up with?
Yeah. Well, you certainly came up with something there. Now, let's talk about the physical part of your show. I mean, if anybody's seen Andrew, if they haven't, you should definitely just Google a video or two, or YouTube a video. It is this full body. You know, the band behind you seems like they're just as involved. Has all this party rock and rocking, like, and touring, has this taken toll on your body? And do you have, like, are you a big guy in the gym or working out? Or is this all just from, you know, your stage presence?
Well, it's a combination of all those things. I think, like just about anything, the more you practice, the better you get.
Right.
So I've refined and fine-tuned my stage technique over the years to what is the most effective, what looks the most. Sometimes things that you think, oh, this must look amazing, it's so exhausting, I'm spending so much energy doing this foot move, I bet it looks incredible. And then you see a video reviewing the show, watching it back to yourself afterwards, and it looks like nothing. You know, I can't believe I spent all that energy doing that footwork, and it doesn't even, you can't even see it. Like, it's obscured by the monitors on stage. So over the years, I figured out what looks the most intense, what feels the best, what I'm able to do, but it is extremely challenging. And I mean, it is for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is. I always wonder that too about other performers. Is this hard for everybody? I don't know how to do it any other way. I don't know how to play. I've tried. I've actually even tried to hold back and kind of relax on stage. I can't fight it. Once the music kicks in, it reaches this level of physical inertia that just takes over.
Right.
But I'm thankful for it because it is its own form of exercise. I mean, who needs to go to the gym if I'm on tour? That's the most intense exercise I could ever possibly get. And you don't even really realize you're even doing it. I mean, you do after you get off stage and you feel like you're going to die, but that's how you know you had a good show.
Right. I mean, and you're a pretty, like, you know, you're a pretty big dude to begin with. You know, like, so I was just wondering if you had to supplement it, like, you know, all this hard work. I don't know if you supplement it with, like, yoga or anything that kind of keeps you stretched out and, you know, to prevent injury.
I mean, I try to always stretch. I stretch out a lot before the shows. I stretch out. So I guess not after. Afterwards, you're kind of all, for me, it's all intuition.
Mm-hmm.
If I felt like I had to do something, I would end up doing it. I go to the gym a lot, though, when I'm not on tour, because I have to. I'm addicted to that physical rush. I mean, nothing gets my mind in order more than blowing my body to shreds from physical exertion. It's one of the most enjoyable kinds of attitude adjustments I've ever been able to rely on, and so the gym for sure is mm-hmm. helpful. But, you know, I take it one show at a time, and I want to be able to do this forever. And whether that's possible or not, you know, there's great role models out there, whether it be Mick Jagger or even James Brown was dancing and playing, performing extraordinarily high energy shows pretty much up to the very end. So it's where there's a will, there's a way.
Now, let me ask you something. You, I kind of think of, you know, I remember hearing about you kind of staying after shows, whatever, 15, 20 years ago, whenever, you know, in the 2000s, and, you know, connecting with your audience, whether it's like, you know, partying with your audience or even just saying hello. Now, I wanted to ask you, to me, you kind of were doing that kind of before, like, social media and things like that, which I think gives artists a good opportunity to kind of connect with their audience. Have you seen, you know, how was it different, you know, back then and now when you can really reach, you know, you could reach all your fans that follow you in a second? Do you see a big difference between those times?
There's a superficial difference. It's a cosmetic difference. It's a surface difference. Because at the heart of it, it's very much the same or even better, just like you're saying, because the ability now, back then, I mean, it was crazy to think that you could, this was 20 years ago, that you could talk to people all around the world sort of in relative real time. I mean, we were having the beginnings of message boards and chat rooms and instant messaging on the computer, and certainly the internet existed. But it wasn't, it hadn't enveloped so many people in its festival-like atmosphere, mm-hmm. where you and where people had accepted it in a way where if someone interacts with you on the computer, it really does count as a real interaction. It really does create a real feeling. It doesn't feel that removed because we've sort of somehow what's the right word? We've made the reality of the computer part of our genuine reality.
I think also it kind of cuts the middleman out a little bit. You know, you're saying whatever you want immediately to your fans, you know, or posting whatever you want them to see rather than, you know, going through a label or whatever it is, scheduling a meeting, you know, you are in control of your image.
Absolutely. You know? It's a legitimate form of connection, and it should not be mistaken as the same connection as, I don't even like a phone call, like the way we're talking now, or the same as an in-person, but it still does count. It still is its own form of connection, and it's great to me. It's an absolute beautiful, powerful tool if it's used for good.
It's like the Force.
Yeah, absolutely. It all depends on how you harness it and what do you direct it towards. If you direct it towards partying, it's awesome.
Now, that's what I wanted to ask you about. So, you know, you got this, your moniker, partying and party hard and party tips. And is it hard to keep that up for so long? And when you say party, are we always thinking like these booze filled parties? Or are you, you know, trying to say party just more like having a good time and kind of channeling that? And has it been hard to keep it up over these 20 years?
It's the easiest thing to keep up because it's already done. I don't have to decide what to talk about. I already know what I'm talking about before I even open my mouth. I'm going to be talking about partying. I love having that focus. I mean, I'm all about a focused point that I'm trying to hit. And the more consistent and reliable I can be, the better I'll be at hitting that bullseye. My whole life work is about hitting this bullseye of feeling. And partying was the best way I could sum up what that feeling was, the celebration of being alive, this ecstatic, euphoric joy that you have just for the fact that you got to exist. And life doesn't always feel like that. So we're trying to create opportunities for that feeling to overwhelm us so that even in those moments of hardship or real suffering, we can still say somehow in some convoluted way, even this pain I'm going through right now counts as partying. And beyond that, I do like to leave it open. I like people to think about it however they want to think about it.
Right.
Because one thing I certainly didn't like, especially growing up, was when people told me how to party, told me that what I was doing for fun was wrong or that didn't count. And it wasn't always the adults. It was even more my peers who said, you're not listening to the right music and you're not wearing the right shoes and you're not dressed right. And even if you do like the right stuff, you're not liking it the right way. And you know, all that was, I said, if I'm going to make a party, it's going to be a total free for all. And I'm just going to set the party conditions. I'm not going to tell anyone what to do. And of course there's a risk with that too, but I have faith in people that they will party the right way for them and allow everyone else to party their way as well.
That's awesome. Now you are, I know you, like, it's amazing to think that, you know, this started from, you know, you were able to open, you know, for the Foo Fighters and work your way through do four albums now. This is, I know you have a new album coming out. Can you tell us about that?
It's out. It's just it's been out for 2 weeks. Well, I don't know when you're going to air this podcast, but it's been out. Just came out. It's called You're Not Alone.
Yep. And so what can we expect from the album?
Well, it's more of the party celebration, as ratcheted up, as intense as I'm able to make it now. I'd like to think that every passing day gives me some new insight into the party spirit that I'm then able to hopefully convey through my work. I mean, I take each song as another chance to get to that feeling. So I'm trying to make the most exciting song I can, finish that one, make another one, finish that one, make another one. And before you know it, you have a new album.
Yeah, that's awesome, and I hope the album does awesome for you. It's cool that you're still pushing through and still, you know, it doesn't seem like maybe you've changed, you know, different influences and whatnot, but you said you're trying to hit that bullseye, and you know, it's like, hey, it's the same, you know, good old Andrew WK that we've come to love. Now, before we go, I wanted to, you know, it's something you touched on early in the interview. You said, like, before you became a musician, you had all these interests in art visual art and other things. And I find it interesting that it seems like, you know, since you did, you know, kind of hit success in music, it seems like you have done dozens and dozens of other things that seem to definitely be like fulfilling different interests of yours, whether it's producing, making soundtracks, being in film and TV. Do you find that now, because of music, you're basically able to open up all your other interests again?
Oh yeah, and that's very well said. And that was something I realized very early on about the entertainment industry or show business, is that pretty much it's all fair game. Anything that you could ever want to do, you can find a way to do it here. So yeah, if you want to make a painting, that painting can be your album cover, or it could be a t-shirt design, or it could be a backdrop on stage. You want to make a movie? Well, you can make a music video, or you could even just make a movie and be in it. That the entertainment has all the space in the world for every type of creativity, especially the visual arts. And that even your whole, the whole work itself, all your efforts can be seen as one giant visual art statement, you know, that also has its own soundtrack. So it's extremely fulfilling. It's an incredible field to work in, because not only do you get to do all these things, but they count towards something. The painting isn't just hanging on someone's wall or in a gallery somewhere. It's alive, it's empowered with meaning, and it's doing something. So that's what I love about it.
Yeah. Well, you're definitely encompassing all that. I want to ask you one last question before you go. I wanted to ask you about the when you had a drum session for 24 hours.
Yes, it was very tiring.
How did you accomplish that? Did you plan like a strategy going in, like, hey, you're gonna keep it slow, going, you know, for certain hours? Did you
was of
it
course, yeah.
kind of jazzy and splashy at certain hours? Did you actually
there was a lot of free form playing, a lot of light playing, a lot of slow playing. My only strategy was to wear golf gloves. Well, no, actually they were drummer gloves, but I wore through them within the first few hours, probably because I don't have the right stick technique. I mean, I've played a lot of drums over the years, but I wouldn't say I'm a professional drummer by any means, and I'm certainly not a very technically good drummer, but I love playing drums, and I've always played them on my albums and loved playing the drum parts. But being in bands with real drummers, I have so much respect for someone who is actually a real drummer. That's what actually made me able to do this session, is I was joined by other drummers who would set up on a kit, sometimes even two other drum kits, and play along with me. And it was the inspiration that I got seeing this other drummer across the room from me, how they played and the energy they brought. They would give me that power to push on through. So, I mean, Questlove drum with me, Chad Smith from Chili Peppers drum with me, Marky Ramone from the Ramones came by to drum with me, among many others. I mean, even Liberty DeVito from Billy Joel's band.
Wow.
You know, he came by. So that's really what powered me through. There was a lot of people online watching, people coming by the actual space. We were in Times Square at the Oakley sunglasses store. Yep. They were looking through the window, cheering me on. I think it was the fact that I'm actually not a professional drummer that enabled me to have such bad technique that I could withstand 24 hours.
That's awesome, man. So where can people go check out the new album, see where you're on tour, and interact with you?
Yeah, well, of course, it's all andrewwk.com, or just put my name at the end of any other website, twitter.com/andrewwk, instagram.com/andrewwk, facebook.com/andrewwk. And the album's available everywhere, physical and online, you know, CDs, vinyl, and all the streaming. And we'll be touring for most of this entire year. So the odds are we'll be coming through wherever you might happen to be, and we'd love to party with you.
Andrew, thank you so much, man. And really good luck with the album, the tour, and I'm excited to see what you do in the future here.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. Have a great time.
All right. The one and only Andrew WK. I got to talk to him for hours there. He's kind of like a, like I said, he's like an enigma. He's like the Loch Ness Monster. It's like, you know, getting Bigfoot on for 20 minutes and then being like wanting to know more of what makes him tick. But I'm glad I got to talk to him. That is the one and only Andrew WK. Unfortunately, you were not available for our next guest either. You know, which happens. Just happened to be off. And
all this time I was unemployed, and now that I'm working, you get guests. I don't get it.
Yeah. it was a secret plan. But this was our first call to Sweden. I had reached out to a guy named Peter Giljam, which I know is not a household name. But another thing I always wanted to have on the podcast, and I've been trying to get a bear trainer on, obviously, because we do bear news and whatnot. But I reached out and was looking for animal trainers and whatnot. And Peter has worked at many different zoos, trained orcas and walruses and giraffes. And he's worked in the Netherlands, and he's worked in the United States and Canada. Very cool guy with an amazing career. Something, you know, I think every kid or most kids has some kind of interest in animals and has at one point in their life thought about like, oh, it'd be so cool to work with animals and whatnot. This guy followed through at 12 years old. He started going to school for this type of thing, which is pretty interesting. But I think you will enjoy it when you get to hear it. But so this is Peter Giljam. Were you ever close to attacked by any kind of animal?
Well, I'm trying to think. I mean, I was a vet tech, so I mean, I had feral cats bite me, dogs, obviously,
fat girls in college.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's any others I can think of. The only other thing I can remember coming down here visiting my parents, and they took me. We went to Wary or something like that. I remember the guy was doing the whole show, if you will, and the buzzard just walked by for no reason and started pecking at my leg.
I picture you getting pecked by a buzzard and be like, "Hey, Mr. Buzzard," like, and giving him like some kind of voice.
That's what kind of happened. I was like, "Oh, this guy's cute," and all. They're like, "It's a buzzard trying to eat you," and I'm like, "Yeah, but you know, he's doing it playfully."
Hey, Buzzard.
Hey, Mr. Buzzard.
Well, you did the vet tech thing. I can never do that. I know personally, I can never do it. Too much sadness for me. How long did you do that?
That was like a good year and a half.
Oh, wow.
Did it on the weekends, and that was fun. I lucked out. I never had a situation where any of the animals got sick. Somebody, I recall, one of the friends, they went out and they had a thing where the person brought the animal up and they opened up the cage and they pretty much saw in the carrier the animal was dead, and the doctor couldn't bring it back. That's about the only scenario I heard of any pet.
Did anybody bring in any exotic animals? Like, this is my pet peacock, or...
But we did vaccinate ferrets with dogs and cats. They were pretty cool, but they're so submissible to getting allergic reactions when they get shot. So, I mean, you have to give them children's Benadryl, where you grab them by the scruff, you pull them back, and they yawn, and you put the Benadryl in their mouth. Then you got to wait 30 minutes for them, and then you can give them the shot. And you can only – they have two shots. They have rabies and distemper, kind of like dogs and cats get the 6-1 or 4-1.
So they have a natural reaction where you pull their scruff back and they yawn?
Yeah, you pick them up and, like, you kind of, as you can see my arm, like, they would be laying like this across your arm, and they would just go, ah, and then you just put the Benadryl down their throat, and they're like...
You sound like...
And then
like,
you have to wait a half an hour.
You sound like the Bill Cosby of vets, like...
Damn it, another lawsuit, damn it. How do they know?
Come here, little ferret. It's all right. Wearing a sweater like Cosby. But yeah, I know I can never do. But the stuff this guy does, I could see myself being very interested in doing. So I think without further ado, here is Peter Giljam from Sweden. All right, it's time to get another guest on the line here. And today we are, I believe this is our first call to Sweden, which is pretty awesome. We've done a lot of Canada. We did a bunch of Europe, England, Scotland, I think we went to. But I think this is our first touch into Sweden. And we're going to get a man by the name of Peter Giljam on the podcast. And Peter is an animal trainer that works all over the world. I've been looking to talk to an animal trainer for quite a while. So he is from Zoo Spenceville. .com, which is a pretty cool site, so you got to check it out. But let's get some insight into Peter's life. So without further ado, here is Peter Giljam.
Hello.
Hey, Peter. It's Scott Brennan from Verbal Shenanigans. How are you, buddy?
I'm very good. How are you?
Ooh, you sound nice and clear, which is good. I was just saying, I think this is our first... I believe this is our first contact in Sweden of all the time we've been doing the show. We've got a couple of Europe, but I think you're the first Swedish caller.
That's good, but officially I'm not
Swedish. Right. That's actually where I wanted to start. And Peter, I looked up your bio, and there's just all sorts of different things of where you were. Where are you originally from?
I'm as Dutch as you can get it, so...
So when did this all start? Yeah, I mean, I read that obviously you always had an interest in working with animals from childhood, but when did this actually start to become, you know, a realistic option as far as a career and whatnot?
Well, so it kind of started when I was in school. So my mom was asking me all the time what I wanted to be, and the funny part was I started to get interested in animals, although we didn't have any animal at home. So, and this was when I was like, I think 10 or 11 or something like this. And then I got this interest in mammals from the ocean, you know? So eventually I went into this school. It was like animal care school or whatever it was. And the cool part of the school was they gave you some experiences, like work related experience fairly quickly. So, after a couple of years, I got to do some practical training, or how you call it, in this zoo, and from there it started off.
So how old were you when you really got it, when you went to this school?
When I went to the school, I was 12.
Wow.
And then, yeah, and I've been on that school for 9 years in total. So it was, for you guys, it's like high school, mm-hmm. and then right after. Where it's college.
Right.
So I could do all at the same school would help me out pretty much, actually.
Now, you had an interest in... I find it amazing that there is, like... that's great that there is an option for someone who kind of knows what they want to do that young. You know, 12, 13 years old. It's pretty young to, you know, start your career path. When did you get started on? You said you had an interest in marine mammals, but was that your intro? Or did you start with, I don't know, dogs and cats?
Well, actually, in school, we had a class, and we were training a dog, and we had some, like, farm animals in school. But, like, I had this interest for especially killer whales, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So I had a goal, and I thought, you know what? I need to reach this goal. That's the point. So I remember my teacher saying to me, well, Peter, what if you can't make it?
Right.
And I was like, you know what? There is no if. I'm going to make this. You'll see. So They gave me a laugh, and they were more like, "Hey, you know what? Let him be in his dreams. We'll see." So, and the fun part then was that I got a job in a zoo where I trained sea lions. And 5 years later, after a lot of networking, I went to Canada. So I went overseas to a park in Niagara Falls. And the first thing I did was calling my teachers that I reached one of the big steps in my career.
Right.
So,
Now, when you are going to train something like a sea lion or whatever you're going to train them to do, is training every animal completely individual, or is there training tips that you use no matter what species it is? Like how I've trained my dog to, I'm able to shoot him and he falls on the ground, which I think is my claim to fame. Like, that's the best trick I've ever taught. But how do you transfer that from dog to sea lion to orca? Is everything kind of food based, or give us a little insight into that?
All right. So it's basically based on science, and the science came, there's a whole history about it, but the whole theory is just when you reinforce something, it happens more often. So
right.
If you discover what the motivation is for the animal, you can basically train anything and everything. So, and motivation is not just giving an animal a cookie or a banana or an apple or so.
Uh-huh.
There's more to it. You know, it's the same for us. Like, we are not just busy with food. We are busy with more things than just food.
Right.
So, and animals is kind of a similar thing. So if I discover what the motivation is for that particular animal, then I can train anything I want as long as if I have a good relationship with that animal. That's what it comes down to.
Now, so like, give us, like, okay, so you said you first start with a sea lion. How much time does it take you to start seeing progress? Is it instant? Is it different? Is every animal individual case, or is there kind of like a protocol that you know by a certain, you know, X amount of weeks, I'm going to have this done, or we're going to be ready to do this? Like, or is it all individual basis?
Well, I do believe that one animal learns faster than the other, but this is also very depending on the trainer. But when I worked in the Netherlands in that park there, we didn't really have a time schedule. So, yes, we tried to train quite some things, but there was not a big time schedule. When I was in Canada, we had a big time schedule, so we had to train quite some things. And then, you know, we trained them for a presentation. So we trained behaviors, how we call it. We could train something within a week if we wanted to. So we were on a pretty high pace, but lately, I'm busy with a lot of other animals. I'm working in a zoo at this point as the training coordinator. And we, you know, a timeline doesn't really work because we are more busy teaching the people how to train the animals. And if you have very young people who don't have so much experience, you can't put them on a timeline yet.
Right.
So, and that's where that's where my passion kind is right now, to teach the people to be able to reach goals with the animals that are just like incredible.
So give us a little rundown on, I don't know, give us just the audience just some of the animals you have been able to train. Give us like a little list here.
Okay, so well, I started with sea lions. Then from sea lions, I went to seals, walruses, dolphins, belugas. Then I went to killer whales. From killer whales, I went to fur seals, gray seals, dolphins again. And from there, I went to all zoo animals. So now we're talking about gorillas, rhinos, elephants, giraffes, you name it, big animals. So, and that's on my list at this point. And then the zoo I'm at, the cool part is that they have quite big groups of animals. So we have a pride of like 10 plus lions, which is very cool to work with. So at this point, I'm it's all zoo animals right now.
Yeah, it's quite a resume there.
Yes.
So, like, for instance, what are, like, we picture, you know, the whales and the sea lions and stuff because a lot of us have seen it at, whether it was SeaWorld or on TV or I've been to a show, but what are you training something like a giraffe or a lion to do? Like, what is the training, what are you trying to accomplish?
So for us, what's the most important part is that we can have proper checks to our animals. So for us, that they come to us so we can see them firsthand is a very important part of their care.
Right.
So we have particular signals where they come to us. We recently trained a giraffe to do a radiography voluntarily. So we ask the giraffe to come to us. We put the camera next to him, and the giraffe stays perfectly still, and we make a picture of his head.
Wow.
So we are very busy with how we call it medical behavior. So now I'm talking about body checks. We train our gorillas to open their mouth so we can see what's out there. We train our lions to do the same thing. We train our giraffes to do radiographies. We train our fur seals to take blood samples, and you name it all. So we're very busy with that medical care, proactive to when they would get an illness, for example.
That's pretty amazing. So I wanted to ask you, so you're currently working in a zoo in Sweden, correct?
That's right.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, we see, you know, the documentaries of Blackfish on SeaWorld, and you hear a lot about zoos changing whether to be more like a rehabilitation center rather than, you know, animals stuck in these cages. We start to get these images, and it seems like the world is becoming more conscious of these type of things, whereas 50 years ago, you know, things were very different. Even in America, the circus, there's no more elephants or lions, stuff like that. How do you – have you seen a change since you started, or has it kind of always been a little bit more progressive and a little proactive? And, like, how do you kind of get that message across that, hey, I don't just work in a zoo and with these caged animals. You are obviously doing some very special things.
Yeah, exactly. So in Europe, it's you have it out here, but not as much. Like, especially in Sweden, the cool part of Sweden is that they are very much into the welfare of the animal itself. Mm-hmm. You know, we get it with us, but I honestly also have to say that throughout the research and all these things we do in zoos, people get these opinions. So at the end of the story, it's because of our research and all that stuff. We know all these things about these animals. Mm-hmm. If we were there, we wouldn't even know that a dolphin is so smart or that that a chimpanzee is so clever. So, you know, there are some points out there, yes. But what you see now very much is that you have the conservation projects. We do quite some at our zoo. What I think is very important, and especially the educational part to the audience, to tell them, like, look, this is the reason you have to protect because.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout our research, maybe you've seen it on my website, throughout our research, we have now a protected area in the Baltic Sea here for the harbor porpoises where they raise their young. Very important things that have happened throughout the zoological community. So I think with that research that we do, we set a base for doing the research for the wild counterpart. So, the progressive zoos are very busy with those kind of projects. And I think that's why it's important to have the zoos these days, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you still see, you know, I think of my nieces and nephews, and you know, there's still always going to be that amazement, you know, of seeing animals you don't see every day. I mean, that goes back to when we were all young, and probably when when you started getting into the idea of this, you probably fell in love just by, you know, experiencing this. So there is something to that, and you know, it's cool to see how it still stays, but it was also like. Like we were just saying, a little bit progressive and kind of changing a bit. Now, I wanted to ask you, I'd be remiss if we didn't ask you, what was the closest call you ever had as far as anything dangerous happened to you? I mean, just the list of animals you've had, I can't imagine what you've seen.
Yeah, well, I've been bitten by sea lions, by seals, I've been chased by walruses, I've been bitten by pelicans.
What was the worst? What was the worst injury that happened to you or closest call?
Well, I think the closest call was the walrus chasing me, to be honest. That's like when you're people say, you know what, walruses are big and fat, but damn, they're fast. So my gosh, that was a very close call. So, and that makes you right away respect them more as well. You know, like, it's not just working with them the way you do, making relationships, but if you see them mad for whatever reason and you see the power they have, yeah, that's just incredible. That's just like, wow, okay.
Right.
Don't get complacent in this situation here, because it's still a walrus. But
yeah,
you know, that was a very close one. Funny things are, like, we have in our zoo, for example, 21 chimpanzees. And I do not know them very well by individual, but every time I come to that team, I'm out there, you know. You know, I had it once. There was a very young chimpanzee, and they started to pee all of a sudden, and I happened to be it. So. So, yeah, these things happen. You know, these things happen. But
I'm sure.
That's why it's so fun.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, just by process of elimination, I'm sure you've got, you know, stories and whatnot. Now, I wanted to ask you, you obviously, when you spend time with these animals, you know, I see these pictures of you with killer whales and walruses. You start to form some kind of bond. Is it hard to, you know, I guess, yeah, as you get more experience, but is it, like, early on or hard to separate yourself from the work you have to do and the bond you have with the animal? And, like, is there one animal that you specifically had a bond with, like, stronger than all the other ones you've worked with?
Yeah, you know, so the thing is that, especially with animals, you build up a certain relationship. And that's why, you know, and I don't want to say I'm talking for all the zookeepers around the world, but the thing is, you're in a particular lifestyle, you know, like, mm-hmm. Zookeepers do not get paid a lot. Zookeepers, like, especially on your side of the ocean, they have two, sometimes three jobs they're going through, but they keep on doing that animal job. And it's all about, you know, taking care of them. It's a lifestyle, really. But for me, I had once, I was the lucky person to work actually with an animal who was deaf or had a hearing impairment. So, and this was one of the whales that I worked with. And I felt a very strong relationship with this animal, definitely. And then the whole, you know, you start to look different at them. You see a connection. There's like, yeah, it's an amazing feeling, really.
Right. I mean, yeah, I just think about the bond, like, the average person has with their dog. Like, you know, like, me and my dog are inseparable, or whatever house pet they have. I just wonder how that intensifies when you're getting into these exotic animals, these killer whales and walruses. I'm sure, you know, and, like, the fact that you are sometimes rehabilitating them is pretty amazing too.
Yeah, you know, so it kind of works exactly the same, building relationship with those animals. So if you have a dog, or if we, you know, we work every day with our animals, so you build those same relationships up, what is very cool. And it's, you know, it's, as I say, it's a particular lifestyle. You have to experience it to understand it, really.
Right. So tell us about ZooSpenceville.com.
Yes, I started ZooSpenceville.com, like, I think it's already 3 years ago. Time was way too fast. Yeah, so, you know, my passion is, believe it or not necessarily the animals. My passion is more the psychology behind it. So, why are certain things the way they go? That's what I'm nonstop wondering. And then I thought, you know what? I started to blog for zoonation.org, and I think, you know what? It's pretty nice. I'm going to start my own website. So I called my little brother, and he's the one who's still designing the website, and he's still my buddy helping me out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yeah, go do it. I built you a website. And then my sister, she actually helped me getting the logo done. So that was pretty cool. So it's kind of a family thing. And then slowly but surely, I got quite some responses to it, that people started to like it. So I started to be more, you know, asking myself, okay, this is pretty all right. Let's see if I can get some content out there where people don't necessarily think of,
right,
but should. So, and that's why I started to put some thoughts out there. Like, what if it's different? What if we think the way we do is not the right way we should do? Because at the end, animals can't talk with us and we can't talk with animals. We are just guessing. So, and I want to try to put that thought into people's minds about, look, you can make statements about things. We are just observing animals. And from our bear, we decide what we think. But at the end of the story, we don't really know. And that's like the magical part of it. And I want to make sure that...
Oh, hello.
Give the animals even a better care throughout the zoological facilities, you know? So that's why I have this website going.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at it right now, you know, there's a lot of different, it looks like, videos and content and articles and whatnot. So it definitely looks like, you know, there's a lot to kind of take in, you know, for anybody that wants to check it out. It is ZooSpenceful, FULL.com. So what do we have to look forward to you for? Like, what do you guys were working on, or what do we expect from you coming out soon?
So... I have a couple of things going on. We have one is pretty cool, actually, urine samples with exotic animals, how it's been trained, how you can do it. I have another one coming out, and that is about, can animals take responsibility, yes or no? And that's always a question that I'm wondering. Like, when we reinforce these animals for what they do and what we would like them to do, do they take responsibility off of this? Mm-hmm. You know, thoughts like this. So I'm busy with that. And then the cool part is I've been invited to go to Australia in November. So I'll be a keynote speaker on an animal training conference. So that's pretty cool. Nice.
How many countries around the world has this job taken you?
So at this point, last year I was in Scotland. I like to visit zoos in general, so I try to pass the name out there. I also have to say that I'm part of IMARA, and that's the International Marine Animal Trainers Association, where I'm the vice president from. So that took me to quite some countries. So I've been, beside my job, beside my website, I've been traveling quite a lot all over the place to visit conferences and such, just to get my name out there, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's pretty special. It's a pretty special career, and it's pretty cool. You know, to connect with someone, like I said, halfway across the world. So it sounds like you're doing good work, and I want to thank you for giving us a few minutes on the show. And I just wanted to ask you, have you ever got, like, any of the animals you train, have you ever trained them for film or television or anything like that, or is it all more just towards the zoos?
I never trained for film or television. I have friends who did and who do. But not myself. I'm more busy with the medical care kind of things, with training groups with the least amount of trainers, these kind of things, who are very, like, those are very specialized, like, topics, right, as well, what I'm very interested in. Yeah. So I never did film and other things.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you so much for giving us a few minutes, and good luck with everything you got going on in the future here.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation.
All right.
All right, Mike. It's not every day you have Andrew WK and a guy that trains giraffes on the same episode.
Well, I would know it's not every day because I miss both days. So.
Well, I'm sorry, pal. Well, it just happened. Just so happened that was the times they can do.
Mm-hmm. Like the time you suggested.
No. Andrew WK, I couldn't get. His people only had 20 minutes at 2 o'clock on a Wednesday.
I'm doing what they call ribbing, Scott.
Ribbed for her pleasure. Yeah. Ew. Yeah. I remember I was obsessed with Wayne's World when I was like a little kid, and I didn't get half the jokes. Like, and I would laugh. Like,
no.
And then like years later, I watched it. I'm like, oh, wow.
They were dirty.
Yep, I love that movie. The first Wayne's World is fantastic. I think the best SNL movie, if you ask me.
It's hard not. I mean, you look down the list, they have more failures than good stuff. I mean, some of their original movies got really well, but then as time went, when they went to like It's Pat and
even like Night at the Roxbury.
Yeah, I mean the quality went down. Like, the actors went on to like good careers, minus Chris Kattan, but
Yeah, well, you know, I never liked him to begin with, so.
Yeah. Did you know that Garth, I'm trying to remember, Mike Myers tried to keep Dana Carvey from being in the movie because he said he was showing him up.
What?
Yeah, I mean, they had great chemistry together, but apparently they don't talk to each other. It was, for what I understand, Mike Myers is kind of a diva. And,
you know, it's SNL. Funny. I could see that. And when I was a kid, I really loved Mike Myers. Like, I guess he just clicked with, like, you know, that whatever age I was. He was, like, the perfect. Like, I thought he was hilarious. Then as I got older, mm-hmm. I actually started to not like him that much. And, like, even when I saw him in, like, interviews and stuff, he did seem like a little bit of a diva, mm-hmm. which is funny because he doesn't do that much anymore. I know he did the Shreks and stuff, and he did that weird Guru movie, but he's kind of...
I remember he did the Cat in the Hat, and he, like, really bitched that he got... It, like, it was in his contract. They forced him into that movie, and he, like, really cried like a little baby that he had to do it, and everybody says, well, if you watch the movie, he really phoned it in, so...
That's weird.
And since then, I haven't heard anything really of him. Yeah, the Shrek movies. His first movie, I remember, I Married an Axe Murderer. That was like his breakout movie.
I liked that movie. Then,
yeah, then there was both Wayne's World. Wayne's World 2 wasn't bad.
Not bad. As far as sequels go, for especially comedy sequels are usually horrific. That one's not bad. That one, Follow the Half Naked Indian.
Yeah, the biggest problem with comedy sequels is it's either A, exactly like the first movie, or B, so far off you're like, what the hell are you doing?
Well, or it's trying to capture that same originality again, like trying to, like, when I think of that, I think of Anchorman. Like, the first Anchorman, it just struck a chord with everybody, and for some reason it was like... It's hilarious. It's still funny. The lines are still funny. And then the second one, just I'm like, I almost, when I heard they were making a second one, I was like, oh no, like I don't want a second one. Like, just leave it alone. And you know, all that Dumb and Dumber. It's like you're never going to capture that movie again. You know, and they've tried.
No, if it
so many times.
Yeah, if it works because it's weird, it's beautifully weird. There's no way you're going to repeat that. So you might as well just say. Good enough. I don't want another Big Lebowski. I don't want any classic comedies to come back again or say, oh, he's the kid of blah, 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 you know?
Exactly. And, like, I think – and what's funny is, like, sometimes, like – like, what made Wayne's role so great? Obviously, Wayne and Garth were great, but all the supporting cast was awesome. Like, you had the little – like, Chris Farley in it and, like – like the other guys that the cameramen that were in it, they were hilarious. Mm-hmm. The Rob Lowe was hilarious. Like it was just all these little other parts that really made the movie just as good. And then you try to like recreate something like that. And like I said, Wayne's World 2 was actually not bad, but like Anchorman, all those guys went off to stardom, you know, after that. Then you know to get that same feeling back, I don't know if it works. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But
what do you think about the Roseanne return? Did you watch that?
I did not watch it. I find it so ironic that liberals are crying yet again, and it's kind of...
Yeah. Well, that's the funny thing. I don't have a problem with the show with her being like a Trump supporter or giving a different view. I think it's refreshing. Yeah. I'll be honest. Like in the first two episodes, my biggest complaint was, okay, you're just living off of jokes of saying, ha-ha, we're back kind of deals. Dan, you were. I thought you were dead. Why does everybody think that? Ha 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 ha.
I have to admit that I was never deep into Roseanne initially. So the excitement about people, the Roseanne, I get it because I know people adore that show and loved it. Yeah. It just was never never in my wheelhouse.
Yeah. I mean, good for them. If people like it, go watch the show. I mean, they need a few more to get me kind of back. I kind of like the original Roseanne. I mean, when they went to the final season, they were so god awful. I mean, leaps and bounds terrible versus the original series. But
okay. So yeah, Roseanne. Like, I think it's good. I mean, I'm always a little weird when shows come back. Like we were just kind of saying anyway,
yeah.
And movies come back, but
Yeah, I mean, my funniest thing with it, they're, you know, proclaiming, oh, this is proof people love the right, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, I can look at the numbers of Will and Grace coming back and seeing the same thing. So it's just nostalgia. God knows what's wrong with this generation. We can't get new things. It has to be, no, we got to bring this back and that back. And then there's 8,000 rumors. Oh, Married with Children will come back, and this will come back, and The Simpsons will never die. So
now is she like a Trump supporter? Is she poking fun at it, or is she actually like that? Is she just making more fun of liberals?
Like she's a Trump supporter, and the girl who plays her sister Jackie is a liberal, so they do the back and forth kind of deals. I mean, the first episode was her saying, you scared me from voting from her, and I voted for Jill Stein, and then he won. And then she's like, oh, he talked about jobs, he talked about this, and it was kind of blatant almost. I mean, I'm not saying this in the fact that, oh, I don't want to hear from the right. Like I said, I'm kind of happy. Oh my God, ABC with Disney and very liberal. I'm happy they put it on. I'm happy to put a different opinion on there. But it's stuff where I say, if I can go, you know what? If this was like one of our podcasts, it's like I could have thought of throwing that in kind of deals, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't care if it's left or right. Like, first off, my TV, I don't watch it for left or right. I feel like if it's funny, it's funny. If it's not, it's going to... You know, it's going to last a couple weeks if it's not funny. So it's got to be funny to stay, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, they got to work on me, but God bless them. If people love it, watch it. I'm not sold yet.
Yeah. Speaking of not funny, I had two interesting comedy experiences this week.
Okay.
So Thursday was Tap House, and... I went up and okay. If I had to rate my set like a 2.5 out of 10, not a good set. And the crowd was good. They were just, you know, I think sometimes they're getting used to me too much. Like they're the same faces come through, and they're like, it's hard for me to trick them. You know, like they know my backstory. Then
they know your setup, your cadence,
right? My divorce stuff. Like they know, like if I'm going into, like they just know. So then,
was it mostly new stuff, or were you playing around with stuff?
I started with like a couple new things that I had thought of that day, and they went over not wonderful, but I kind of used that room as a place for me to try stuff, and
I hear.
And it just wasn't a great connection, but whatever. So the day goes on, and we're at the headliner, and he's doing okay, not great. And I get a call. Now, Alex had been sick for like a day or two before. She wasn't feeling well. Her stomach was getting worse, and I was just like, just trying to go to sleep and whatnot, and like, you know, she said she was feeling nauseous all day, and then she was like throwing up a little bit. I'm like, oh, you probably got a stomach bug or whatnot. And I had lit the headliner, so it was about maybe 5 minutes left in the show. And Tina from Tap House comes up to me. She was like, your dad just called the Tap House line. The restaurant, and
the signal went up in the air. Yeah. It was a big beer tap.
And she's like, he said, call them back whenever you get a second. You know, call them all on your mom's phone. I'm like, first off, one, that's weird that they didn't call me, like my cell phone. And two, I'm like, oh boy. So, and then at the time I was getting messages from like my brother and my sister-in-law that, Alex wasn't feeling well, and that she was... You know, like getting pins and needles in her hand and throwing up a bunch, and that she was going to go to the ER. And I'm like, oh boy. So now I'm trying to get out of there, and the headliner is just not getting off. I'm like, come on. Like, I lit him like four times. And I knew it was bad when I lit him, he does a really good joke at the end, right? And he gets a big laugh, like where he should have got off. And then he's like, "So where are you from?" Afterwards, I'm like, "Oh God!" Like goes back into the crowd. I'm like, "Come on, dude." You know,
one of those. He's like, "That felt good. I'm going to double down."
Yeah. Like once you hear someone go, "Where are you from?" I'm like, "Oh boy, now you're going to do crowd work. Now you're going to do crowd work to set up your next bit." Like, come on, get off. And so, long story short, I ended up getting. You know, I had to go up and like we do a charity thing there, so I had to do the raffle, and I couldn't just leave. I had asked Rob to do it. I'm like, you know what, I'll just do it because my sister-in-law's like, everything's okay, but. So eventually I just left my stuff there afterwards and then went to the hospital and everything was okay. Basically just stomach bug or food poisoning or whatnot. But I realized that I am horrific at like sitting and waiting around in the hospital. I have zero patience.
Okay. Like how long were you there before you started getting like jittery or okay.
So I had gotten there at just around 10:30. They got there around 10. And we didn't leave there until about 2:30, 2:45. So a nice 4 hour stint and all it was empty. Mm-hmm. It was like a ghost town. There was nobody in the rooms next to us, like nothing. And you know that they gave her like an anti-nausea medicine and then hooked her up to two IV bags. And she finished a one IV bag. And I'm like, okay, cool. We're going to get out of here. And then he comes in. He's like, all right, we're just going to run this whole second bag. I'm like, oh my God. You ever, if there is something that is the worst thing to watch if you want time to pass, watching an IV drip is probably the worst possible thing to like try to pass time.
You're like grabbing it like one of those cake decorator bags and just like pushing it. Go, go.
That's what I said to her. I said, "You want me to double time this? We'll be out of here in 15 minutes." You know, just
open your mouth and chug.
So yeah, I just start pacing.
You put a straw in there like a Capri Sun.
And then I'm thinking to myself like, this, yeah, she probably doesn't need the second bag. Like, where is this guy? And just everything in the emergency room takes so long. They're like, all right, we're just going to come back and, you know, get your prescription and you'll be checked out. That takes another half hour. And it's like, all right, like, we're going to hook this up. And that takes a half hour. And there was no one there. I can't imagine what it'd be like if there was, like, mayhem. So... So that was pretty weird and pretty, you know, a crappy night. You ever get food poisoning?
I got it once pretty bad. I didn't have to go to the hospital, but it was one of those things. I remember I was on vacation and then like on the Sunday after I started feeling kind of bad and I slept. I never had slept before. I had zero energy. I remember basically sleeping 16 hours that one day because I could not get up. And every time I'm like, all right, I got to get up and do this or that. I would just conk out and then like another 6 hours passed. So I went to the doctor and I remember he was basically first telling me, he's like, I think you either have appendicitis or diverticulitis. And it was Thanksgiving. It was coming up on Thanksgiving. So for his concerns, he basically told me I couldn't eat solid foods for a week going into Thanksgiving. So that was right off it. Then what added to my kind of anger about it, like I told a friend, because basically as they were testing, he was like pushing on my stomach. He's like, how does that feel? And
the doctor, not your friend. Right.
No. And
my friend was pushing on my stomach.
Yeah, it was a weird. Hello, okay. That's how you say hi. But he like pushed down. I think on my right hand side, and where I'm like, yeah, there's discomfort there. That's how he diagnosed it. And I was talking to a friend. He's like, you know, your appendix are. He said, you know, that stuff's on the left hand side, right? I'm like, what? He's like that. The doctor didn't know where your organ is supposed to be. The observation. So of course, after a week of just having like liquids, I the doctor didn't even say anything. I actually went to his office just as it was closing, and he was closing up shop. I'm like, hey, doctor, you told me to just be on a liquid diet for a while. He's like, well, how are you feeling? I'm like, I feel good. All right, stop it. And then he walked past me.
I had food poisoning so bad. It was just after I had done my student teaching, so I was working, trying to get a job, like I was doing substituting and whatnot, and I went to work, stomach wasn't right, you know, it was kind of ugh all day. Mm-hmm. It hit me around like 1 o'clock, like right after lunch, and I must have, just at work, I must have pooed probably 11 times in like an hour. Like, I remember even like leaving kids in the classroom to run out and go, like, I was like, I just, you know, this has to happen, or it's going to be disaster.
Yep.
Or it's going to be disaster. So I remember asking, I said, I got to go. Like, I have to leave. And I'm like stubborn when it comes to like the doctor. I'm like, So all night, like every 10 minutes, I was on the toilet. Like every 10 minutes, to a point where I had brought a blanket into the bathroom because I just was laying on the floor. And this is, I was still living at home and my parents knew about. And then, you know, 5 in the morning, maybe dump number, you know, the 60, it felt like. Honestly, the number was probably, I'm not kidding, probably in the 30s, like how many times I went.
Wow.
And there was just nothing left. Like my butthole was just blown out and just sore. Like I couldn't even touch it. I just had to like dab.
And Lord knows, guys try to touch it. So, yeah, I mean, that was a bad feeling.
And I just had to like basically tap it with toilet paper. It hurt so bad. Finally, around like 4:30 in the morning, like my dad or your mom or whoever knocked on the door, and I was like, oh, and they're like, you gotta go to the hospital. Like it's been going on for like 15 hours straight. And I had went to the hospital, and they're like, you know, it's hard to tell if stomach bug or like gastritis or whatever it is. And they're like, we're going to have to do some, observations. So he's like, he comes in, you know, sure enough, puts a glove on, and he does the old, turnover, and he does the old two fingers up the butt. And that was horrendous. That hurt horribly bad. And even then, I was trying to, like, joke, you know, probably the same joke that every guy has ever made during their, anal exam. You know, like, hey, you know, like, I don't even know your number yet. You know, it's all that stupid. All that
take me out for dinner first.
Yeah. All the, like, hacky prostate, like, prostate exam jokes that you hear in the comedy circuit. But
which you can hear at Tap House 15 next month.
No. From me. But then they were like, okay, like, because I was in horrible pain. Like, they're like, we're going to put you on a morphine drip. And I'm like, all right.
Oh, wow.
And, Mike, I'll tell you, I know exactly why people do morphine and heroin. Like, the instant they put it in my IV, it was like my whole body was warm, and I wasn't thinking about food poisoning anymore. And I just like felt like I was kind of like floating above my bed a little bit. Like I was like, oh, all right, this is pretty cool. And then, recovered. And I knew it was bad when like for 3 days, like my farts did not stink whatsoever. Like nothing. There was nothing left in my body. Like I cleaned the whole house out, you know. But it was pretty atrocious, man. Pretty atrocious.
Oh, man.
But the second, I'll quickly go through the second weird comedy story. I did KP Burke, a fellow comic, asked me to come do some time on a fundraiser in West Milford, New Jersey. Now, Burlum, West Milford, New Jersey is a very...
born and raised.
Very farm boy, country bumpkin... woodsy people, you know, that's what I can say. A lot of flannel, a lot of Carhartt, a lot of boots in the audience.
Kind of your opener being, who are Dale Jr. fans in here?
Yeah, yeah. It was at the Elks, so you know right away what you're kind of getting into when you go to one of those places, plus in West Milford. So it was, you know, I knew it was going to be that kind of crowd. They were all loaded before the show. And and this is not actually about me bombing, but it was about our good friends, Rich and Joe. So Natty went up, did a good job, but it was just bad setup. Like, the light was clipped to the table in the front. It was like a Home Depot light, and it was so bright. I couldn't get into my set until I stepped to the right out of the light because I couldn't see the crowd. It was, like, blasting in your face. It was like being on, like, the Tonight Show, I'd imagine, where you can't see anything, but, you know, like, it's a teleprompter. Yeah. But this was not the Tonight Show, by the way. Not the same caliber.
No? Oh, man.
And Natty goes, does a good job. KP goes, does a good job. And even during his set, people are just yelling out random things. I go up. I did fine. You know, like, I give myself like a 6.5, 7 out of 10. Fine set, you know. Okay. Nice long set. It was good. But then Rich and Joe go up. And at that point, the audience was loaded. Okay. Now, McDonald and Carney are an improv act. So, right away, that takes a little give and take from the audience to be successful. You know, like, it takes, and they are great at what they do. They headline all over the place. They're funny as hell. But right away, you started hearing the moving around, the rumbling around, and people yelling things out. They were about 20 minutes in, and it got so bad, people were just getting up and leaving, coming up to us like, "This isn't funny," like yelling at us and like stuff like that, and people screaming things out. They were screaming for some guy. You know how every like club or whatever has got the real funny guy that can go, they're calling for his name, like, yeah, because it's, you know, him telling
Kevin, get up there, go do your thing.
That was exactly what it was like. His name was like Raymond or something like that, and people were starting to yell like, Raymond. I'm like, oh my god, this is, Alex was with me, she was like absolutely appalled. I'm like, babe, this is what happened. So I'm like, this is like kind of the crappy part of this, and like, so, you know, they're doing.
So that's the first place you take her after she had food poisoning.
Yeah,
so curious.
Yeah, I'm a true romantic. And they are just so bad. And I'm sitting there to KP. I'm like, just light them, just get them off. Like, they don't deserve the show at this point if they're gonna act like animal. And then there started to be like people who are still into the show yelling at people who weren't into the show, and I'm like trying to like help out. Like, there's people in the back talking. I just go up nicely, be like, "Hey, like, do you mind, like, you know, they're trying to perform, do you mind going, like, if you want to go to the bar, just go to the bar, because you'd rather perform in front of 20 people that want to be there than 100 people, 80 of them screaming and yelling and being ridiculous." But man, I mean, they eventually got some people on their side, but my god, was that embarrassing. It was like, not embarrassing for them, embarrassing for the people of, like,
yeah,
just acting like animals. Like animals. Listen, if you don't like a show, people who are listening, if you don't like a comedy show, you don't have to laugh at all. Okay? That is our job, to make you laugh. Okay? Does it happen every night? No.
Mm-hmm.
You also have the option, if this is not for you, to walk up and leave, like, just to get up and leave. That is fine too. Like, does it suck for us? Of course it does, but you're not disturbing the people who want to be there. When you have 100 people making it about themselves and like they're screaming and like you're embarrassing yourself, they're all embarrassing. And it, honestly, it was like, it's pretty disgusting, like, how bad that crowd turned, because maybe that was something they weren't used to, or, you know, they were tired or too drunk, but it was so bad. I felt, you know, and they took it like champions, and I guess you get used to that kind of thing, but it was just, it was rough. It was rough, is what I'm saying.
All right, we need an activity. Sucking!
It was bad, man. It was just,
we need a person. You're an asshole!
It's just, you start to embarrass yourself as the crowd. Listen, every comic's gone up there and eaten loads of shit for a long time, and they can get through it. But when people are screaming and yelling like that and carrying on, they don't deserve the rest of the show. They don't deserve. It's time. Exactly. Like, get off the stage and you know, it was run by your friends, so you're never gonna get paid. You know. Berlow just did like a front flip off the bet.
I think that was a missus.
Was that the Cirque du Soleil portion of the pocket? You just did like a front roll and took your headphones off. It was a very sexy move.
Yeah, I'm just going to take the rest from the phone because I think the internet messed up again.
Yeah, that's fine. That was went into remix mode again. It was like hata 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 hata. It's pretty great, but So that was nice watching you do a front flip there. That was pretty cool.
You know, I aim to entertain. Don't always do it, but there I did for once.
Well, I mean,
we should do it with audio since this is a podcast.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I guess you are you're all set now in Georgia, right? You got the dog, and you got the girlfriend are down.
Yep, the missus, the dog is down here. The license changed over. Just got the insurance today. We'll be going to the single license plate pretty soon. I go up to Jersey on the 14th to get the rest of the remains, and then there she's done, for lack of a better term.
And so how's it going? How let's give us like the Georgian update. How is life down there?
Georgia, life is good.
Berlow's Georgian update.
Yeah, we had the family Easter. The brother came down. Had a lot of fun. They were picking on Izzy a lot. We had a bunch of laughs. It's going great this weekend. We're going to the Georgia Grand Canyon.
The Georgia Grand Canyon?
Yes. Georgia apparently has a Grand Canyon-esque park. So we're checking it out to see what that's like. See if it's as good as Georgia pizza, for lack of a better term. So,
oh, I'm looking it up as we speak. Georgia Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. So Georgia Grand Canyon, Providence Canyon, it's called. All right, it looks nice. It definitely looks nice. It's not the Grand Canyon, but it definitely looks pretty beautiful. Actually,
no, it's not the size of the Grand Canyon. It's an hour and a half. It's an hour and a half away, but it's dog friendly, so he is in the Cali. We'll
jump into the canyon.
Down the hole. Yeah, see if we can get our way back up afterwards, you know?
Well, I mean, I feel like if it was the size of the Grand Canyon, we would all know about it, so it makes a little sense.
Yeah. Scott, it was just a pothole. It was the weirdest damn thing.
Well, I'm glad you guys are all back. I saw you guys are right back in the swing of things, taking interesting photos from what's the name of the town?
Sonoya. It's Sonoya, which was Woodbury in The Walking Dead.
No.
We forgot that we were by where they tape and all that. Alexandria, you can actually see it from the railroad tracks. They have the metal gates all around, and I mean, obviously you can't see in if they're shooting. I mean, it's all private property, but you can see the outside exterior of it.
Anything cool there? Is it cool to check out, or is it kind of just a normal town?
It's definitely cool. We had dinner at Nick and Norman's. That's owned by Norman Reedus and Nick Grigatero, one of the producers of the show. We might go there next Sunday for their dinner over there during The Walking Dead. They have a whole event where all Walking Dead fans show up there. There's like a three-course meal, and everybody watches the show together. So, you know, we're going to check that out.
How far is that?
That's like 10 minutes from my my parents' place.
Wow, 10 minutes. All right.
Yeah.
So
yeah, my dad used to tell me when he when he was driving home, when he used to go to work, there'd be roads closed, and he'd just be like, yep, there's even Walking Dead over there.
And so they've kind of cashed in on the, like, the touristy part of it, or is it still kind of like a normal town?
Yeah, it's a very small, quaint town, kind of like Chester, but they also do tours where they show off, you know, different places where they tape the show, and They also have, like, people or lookalikes who walk around. One day we saw somebody that looked like Rick, one that looked like the governor. I'm trying to think who else.
It would suck if they just looked like that and lived there, like, their whole life. And like, or like,
they won't let us out, man.
Or there's just like one
lifelong contract really means it.
Or there's just one Asian guy that lives there, and everyone's like, Glenn. He's like, God damn it!
God damn it! I'm gonna kill it. God, why call me that?
My name is Steve. Well, anything you got before we can get out of here?
I guess I'll just do my promotion. I will talk about the A7FL. They are starting the new season this coming week. It'll be already out by the time this episode goes out. But they're going to be showing their games on YouTube. There's a lot of promotion going on for it. If you're in the New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Florida area, they have teams there. So check out A7FL.com.
All right. And I wanted to promote a good friend of mine and the podcast. She was on very early on in the show. It was actually before Burloop. But fellow comic Pamela Ray, Pam Schuler, used to go by the name of Rayla Bloom. She's doing a lot of really mm-hmm. cool things. She is being honored alongside Ed Asner, which is pretty crazy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Celebrating the voices of Ed Asner, Leanne Carter, and Pamela Schuler. She's getting, you know, some type of award, which is pretty crazy. So go check her out. She's been, you know, she's been doing things like TED, like her own TED Talks and doing a lot of things for, like, you know, kids with like disabilities or, you know, Tourette's or whatever it is. So she's really killing it. And she'll actually be on the Rebel Shenanigans Tap House show, not this month, but the month after. So go check her out. She deserves it. She's a great person. So make sure to check her out. But with that, Berlou, I think it's time to wrap up another one of these guys. We're kind of piecing together a bunch of different interviews and episodes and kind of catching up, but we are plowing along here and we're figuring out some of the technical difficulties and whatnot. So what you can do for us is hit like and share and comment and all that fun stuff, and check out the BS Podcast Network. We are proud to be part of that. And most of all, for us, definitely, the most important thing is, for me, is definitely go check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, there's a lot more really, really good episodes, or at least good guests. Maybe we're not good, but the guests are really good. So go check them out. With that, life is funny, people. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Thanks so much for listening. Good night. When it's time to party, we will party hard.